It's Ideasphere with author and journalist Bruce Dances. Resistor.
I think if the governments have learned anything from the Vietnam experience, is that if you have conscription, you have a draft for an unpopular war, you are going to have an amazing amount of dissent to that. And they learned you can't fight an unpopular war with a conscripted army. And they went to, quote, the all-volunteer army, for better or for worse.
When Bruce Dances arrived at Cornell University in 1965, he was no stranger to political action. He even took part in a march on Washington 2 years earlier. Now, he was ready to defy the draft. The Vietnam War was heating up. So what did he do? He became the political organizer of the first mass draft card burning, an activist in a national resistance movement. And he spent 19 months in federal prison for his actions against the draft. Hello, I'm Guy Rathbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with journalist Bruce Dances. He had a long career as a pop culture music critic and editor, including 16 years as the arts and entertainment editor of the Sacramento Bee. He's written a book about his experiences. In Resistor, Dances gives us an insider's account of the anti-war and student protest movements, and he provides a rare look at the prison experience of Vietnam-era draft resistors. Bruce Dances joins me for this program. Thanks for taking this time.
Thank you.
You have written a seminal work on the act of resisting. The first thought is, as someone seeing your book on the shelf might ask themselves, hasn't there been enough written about this over the years? What's new here?
Well, it's funny. When I started researching this after I took a buyout from the newspaper where I worked for many years, the Sacramento Bee, I found there actually wasn't very much written about it. And most of the things written about the draft resistance movement or draft resistance in prison, they were both few and they came out in the 1970s. I felt that it was a story that had not been told in a long time, and it was also a story that had not been told, I think, from the vantage point of someone who has lived through those times and has thought about them for a long time. And I'm both critical and positive about what I did and what me as part of the movement did.
Someone reading your work is going to be curious what led you to this. You were from a middle-class family. You had attained a level that many don't, and that is entrance to a very prestigious college, Cornell University. One person wrote years later that she thought you had thrown your life away.
Right.
But you had taken it up on yourself, inadvertently actually, to become essentially a leader of the resistance.
I think what happened, if you look back at the time, every young man and every woman who cared about young men who were of draft age from, say, 1965 until the draft lottery came in 71 or so, was affected by the draft and the war in Vietnam. The war was unpopular, particularly on college campuses. It got more unpopular as time went on. By the time I was a freshman at Cornell in 1965, I was already against the war. I thought it was unjust, it was illegal, and it was a disaster for America, for our troops who were sent there, and for the Vietnamese people. So I knew I was not going to fight in Vietnam. I made that decision. But I felt that, yeah, as you said, as someone who grew up in relative affluence, by no means rich, but we were certainly solidly middle class, I was able to go to college and get a 2S deferment, a student deferment if I wanted to. But I felt that that was really unfair, that poor kids or kids who didn't have the same academic background that I had couldn't get into college and were immediately eligible for the draft, whereas I could sit there for 4 years and avoid the issue. And I just felt that was fundamentally wrong. So when I did register for the draft, I rejected a student deferment. I said I couldn't accept that. But within a short time after that, I felt that any cooperation with the Selective Service System and the draft just wasn't right. I didn't think any of the alternatives were right. I did feel that we needed to build a movement to oppose the draft and the war. And if it meant that I had to take an action, say, before other people were ready to do so, I was willing to do that.
You say you wanted to do something with the movement to stop the war, yet you spent decades following prison time and the protests you and others organized, believing that you had failed in that effort.
It's true. I think the anti-war movement, I did feel, was somewhat successful. I think the war dragged on much longer than we hoped it would, until 1975. The casualties are unbelievable. 58,000 American troops died, but the estimates of Vietnamese who died are in the millions, civilians and soldiers, north and south. I did think the anti-war movement had some impact on constraining the ability of both the Johnson and the Nixon administrations to really escalate the war and make it even worse than it was. There were talks about using nuclear weapons in North Vietnam, sending American ground troops into the north, completely wiping out cities like Hanoi and Haiphong, and I don't think they were able to do that. I think the memoirs of various government officials in the administrations indicate that they were very aware of the anti-war movement's growth and power, especially among young people. I think we did have an effect. We certainly had an effect on Congress, which eventually voted to stop supporting the dictatorship in South Vietnam. The public opinion polls also showed that the public turned rapidly against the war. Many GIs turned against the war. The anti-war movement among active duty soldiers in Vietnam was extensive. And by 1971 or so, the leading edge of the anti-war movement were Vietnam veterans. So I think we can see some tangible success of the movement there. You're right. I didn't think for a long time that we had been successful. Our goals was to build a massive movement of young men resisting the draft, being tried, going to prison, and that would have been filling the prisons. I guess in our wildest dreams, we hoped we'd really affect the ability of the U.S. to get enough soldiers to fight in the war. And we didn't do that. But I did find out later from studies that actually we did make it very hard for the government to prosecute all the young men who committed acts of draft resistance. Ramsey Clark was the Attorney General under President Johnson, and he said afterwards, well, our policy was not to go after everyone. That would have been thousands and thousands of people. We just went after the ringleaders, people who caused so much trouble we sort of had to go after them, and I guess I fit into that group. But I didn't know this at the time. At the time, I thought, well, we tried. Maybe we weren't very good organizers, and maybe organizing a movement where the end goal is to put people into prison is really not the best strategy. But for me, it seemed like the only thing I could do.
You mentioned that the courts were overcrowded. It's interesting as a reader to find this out for a couple of reasons. One is that your goal was to see if you could actually load the prisons with all of these young men, most of them college right. students, and that was unsuccessful because the courts were overcrowded.
Right.
The courts dropped so many cases. Well, what that caused was the press to ignore it, so no one really knew that was going on.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. It's also true that, you know, once President Nixon instituted the draft lottery, that immediately eliminated, say, a third of the men who were the high numbers. They weren't even going to be considered. Most of the men in the middle third were not going to be drafted. So really the only people who were in jeopardy was the first third. And that definitely took some of the impetus out of the draft resistance. That is, if people thought they could get a number that was high enough, they were not interested in resistance.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with author and journalist Bruce Dances, Resistor, a story of protest and prison during the Vietnam War. This is now available in hardcover. You have a website, blog, or anything else you'd recommend for your readers?
Well, I do have a Facebook page just under my name, Bruce Dances, D-A-N-C-I-S. There's a very good page at my press, which is a Cornell Press at cornell.edu, which has a bunch of reviews and other information about me and the book and things like that.
Now, this is interesting. Cornell Press publishing the material. You were a student at Cornell.
Right.
And I couldn't help but wonder, as I was looking at your book, what kind of resistance did you face from Cornell? Any at all? Or was it now understood that the past should not affect your present?
Well, there was a certain irony, I admit, you know, in my finding Cornell as a press, simply because as a student activist and later, even after I dropped out, we were a thorn in the side of the Cornell administration on a number of issues.
Exactly.
Support of African-American students fighting to get a Black Studies program towards divestment of Cornell holdings and banks dealing with South Africa's apartheid regime. I mean, a whole bunch of issues. I think Cornell has actually done a pretty good job of reconciling its history. They do have regular conferences that commemorate the actions of the African-American students in 1969, where they seized the student union and big controversy there. And I think it was actually the first press I went to. I just thought that the audience, I was reaching the right audience. I hoped I could also break out of Cornell and get to other people, other readers, obviously. But I sent it in. After a cover letter, they said they were interested, and they immediately said they wanted to publish it. So I never went anywhere else.
Impressive.
As you mentioned it, I do recall thinking, boy, at the last minute, is some administrator going to say, you can't publish a book by that guy? But that never happened.
It's interesting. You just mentioned a key phrase, and that is the civil rights movement, the movement of the blacks in the 1960s. That conflict was going on at the same time. I'd like to look at that for a moment, because there are so many in the minority who were going to serve in Vietnam. It was obvious, but they were underprivileged, did not have the capabilities of a protest of the war.
Right. And civil rights leaders like Dr. King, Stokely Carmichael, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, were very early on seeing the disproportionate number of people of color who were fighting and dying in Vietnam. That was always an issue for them. Muhammad Ali was probably the most famous draft resister of the era in the heavyweight boxing champ. You know, he was famous for his statement that I got nothing against the Viet Cong. You know, they never did anything to me, compared to, say, racism in America or something like that. So that was very much an issue. But the civil rights movement was crucial to my own development. I mean, as a high school kid in New York City in the early 60s, the people who were my heroes then and have been my heroes my entire life were the civil rights workers in the South who risked their lives trying to organize people to get the right to vote, and the teenagers in Birmingham, Alabama, who were the same age as me, who stood up to police dogs and fire hoses and jail and beatings just to demand their basic human rights. So, I mean, that has always been the model for me of people resisting, you know, an illegitimate authority, resisting evil. I admire them no end. And, you know, the whole concept of putting your body on the line for what you believed in, to me, came from that experience.
Putting your body on the line, did you realize you were 19 years old? Did you realize the impact this could have? And I know you wrote later how troubling this must have been for your parents, and that's another interesting story in itself. But how about your own awareness of the potential?
Well, I knew that I was going to face danger. You know, actually, when I tore up my draft card, I was only 18. I was a sophomore in college, but I was a young sophomore because I had skipped a grade earlier in junior high. I don't know. I mean, I just felt that I could deal with prison. I don't know why I thought that, but I thought I could deal with prison. I had friends advising me, man, you got to take some self-defense courses or lift weights. See, I'm not a big guy. I'm around 5'7", and those days I weighed around 130 pounds. So obviously, I'm not the strongest guy going in. But I just felt it was something I had to do, and, you know, I would face the consequences. I did think that, you know, I had a personality that was such I get along with most people. I don't look down on people. I was always taught by my parents to respect everyone's work, and certainly I didn't look down on people, say, from working class backgrounds or people of color or anything like that. So that certainly helped me in prison. In prison, anyone who had gone to college got a job as someone with white collar jobs, like in the medical department or education, and I was a teacher. And I ended up working with a lot of guys who were illiterate, you know, to help them learn how to read, or guys with eighth grade education to get them up to high school, or get guys their GEDs. You know, I was working with guys with swastikas tattooed all over their arms, and I managed to, you know, get along with them. And I think they got along with me because I was clearly trying to help them do something they needed to do to get paroled.
Let's take a look at your background and your parents for just a moment, because they influenced you greatly in your political life and your views when you went to college, and beforehand, in fact, back into the early 1960s. They were what you would refer to as democratic socialists.
Right. They were members of the Socialist Party. They were followers of Norman Thomas at that point. I mean, they very much agreed. They believed in socialism, but they believed that socialism that would come to America by the ballot. thought. They were harshly anti-communist for the entire time. In fact, one of the odd things about my parents is that as strong as they were as supporters of civil rights against racism, they were so anti-communist that they took a long time to turn against the war in Vietnam. They did not see it as a civil war. They didn't see it as a continuation of the war against colonization, which I did. But, you know, they didn't agree with me. They respected me. They knew where I was coming from. They loved me, but they didn't agree with me. I mean, when I dropped out of college, my parents cut me off. They had been helping me go to college. You know, I did have a scholarship, but, you know, in terms of room and board and things like that, they were wonderful to me and my brother. But my mother said, I remember at the time saying, if your movement needs you so much, let them pay for you. I mean, they were very principled. When I told them I was about to tear up my draft card, they immediately drove the 6 hours from New York City up to Ithaca, New York, where Cornell was, to try to talk me out of it, or at least get me to postpone it. But I think they also knew how stubborn I was, and that didn't work. But I'll say this, you know, once I did commit my actions, they were, other than financial support, in terms of moral support, they were wonderful. They attended all my trial. My mother testified at my trial. Once I was in prison, they drove 11 or 12 hours over the weekend. They both worked at that time to visit me once a month, which is all they could visit me. When I did get out of prison and went back to college, I was back on the family dole again. So my parents, really, I mean, I was very fortunate because other resistors and other anti-war people had much harder times. I mean, the generation gap was real in the 60s.
Sure. Well, eventually they came around to your way of thinking.
Well, my mother did more than my dad. By the early 70s, she was going to anti-war demonstrations, and there's a photo of her we have somewhere in the family of her carrying a sign, "Free my draft resistor son from prison." My dad, I don't know. I think his love for me and support for me overrided any political objections he might have had. But we argued about politics for the rest of their lives, so maybe that's something that just my family did. You can still love each other and have political disagreements.
Regrets.
Yes.
You have a few of those, but you still see the work you did as meaningful.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I do see myself as part of a larger movement. I think I played an important role in it, but, you know, I was affected by things that were going on. Looking back on it, the organization that I was involved in the late 60s, Students for Democratic Society, SDS, I mean, we had some serious problems with sexism in the organization, both nationally and in our chapter at Cornell. The women's movement was just coming into life in the late 60s, and I think the initial response was, well, compared to what the Vietnamese are going through, or compared to what African Americans are going through, these concerns are not as important. I think later, by the 70s, men in the movement certainly changed around that, and I'm glad we did, and I did. But at the time, I think, I regret that. I think that our movement, although not me so much personally, but certainly my friends and a lot of my people I worked with, we sort of abandoned nonviolence and were involved in actions, often as in response to police brutality, but we got into violence of our own. And I think we lost some of the appeal that we should have had we been able to maintain a strict policy of tactical nonviolence. So I do regret that. But I think it was difficult to oppose a war. At that point, we were shattering the Cold War consensus, and it was hard to do, and it took a lot, and there's a lot of government repression or attempts to suppress us, led by the FBI and some of its counterinsurgency programs in the United States. So, I mean, given all that, given how young we were, how little money we had and all that, I think we did a pretty good job.
My guest is Bruce Dances, journalist and author of Resistor, A Story of Protest and Prison During the Vietnam War. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Ideasphere here on Public Radio KCBX. Coming up at the top of the hour, it's the Splendid Table. This week, the Splendid Table asks the question, who owns the world's superfoods? It's the battle over quinoa with journalist Lisa Hamilton. Also, hear the story of wine entrepreneur Jess Jackson of Kendall Jackson Vineyard Estates. And the duo from the award-winning Perennial Plate take us to Argentina for the tradition of mate. That's the Splendid Table coming up at 2 o'clock here on Public Radio KCBX. The time is now 10 minutes before 2.
You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with journalist and author Bruce Dances, Resister. There were those who stood at your side during the protesting of the war, but later they changed their stance, and I'm thinking of one in particular, Chip Marshall.
Yeah. I never talked to Chip about that. We have not been in touch. And I saw him once after I got out of prison, but that was before he made his statement about that. Well, I disagree with him strongly. I mean, I think one can be critical of the society that the North Vietnamese set up through the entire Vietnam for its lack of civil liberties, its lack of rights, other rights. Certainly, bad decisions were made. However, I think that the people they were up against were as bad, if not worse, the one collection of military regimes in the South. I think after a civil war that had gone on for so long, there was bound to be repression afterwards of the people on the losing side. I mean, it happens in every war of independence and civil war. But the Tories, you know, maybe a quarter of the U.S. population in the Revolutionary War either left for Canada or back to England or were subject to harsh reprisals. I regret that that happened. I think Chip might have been reflecting on that. You can't do that with history. At the time, my concern was what is being done in my name, what is being done by the U.S. government, and I have no doubt that we were right in opposing the war at that time.
During the latter portion of the war, the veterans who had served in Vietnam were now home, many of them, and they protested the war themselves, many of them throwing their medals back over the fence. But there was one in particular now, John Kerry, a cabinet member. But back then, when he was shown to have protested in a military uniform, essentially, he wasn't. He was dressed as a civilian. That was a moment of pride for your group. However, John Kerry handled it differently when it came to this exposure. Were you disappointed in any way?
Well, yes. Now, I was very proud of Kerry and all those anti-war GIs. To me, the single most gripping demonstration that I've ever heard about against the war was that action you referred to, Guy, you know, when the GIs were tossing back their medals at the U.S. Capitol. That was unbelievable protest and tremendous guts and tremendous character, I thought. Kerry, I think, was always, as I learned more about him, was an ambitious guy. I think he always saw a political future ahead of him. I was disappointed that he sort of ran away when he was running for president from his anti-war credentials. I don't think it was wrong for him to talk about his work, what he did as a soldier, and he was injured and all that, and the swift voting against him by the right wing was just absolutely repulsive. But I wish that Kerry had said yes, and we were opposed to the war, and I made some statements about that I still believe in. He sort of did. And that was at first. I wanted to write about that, but my position at the newspaper was such that I was part of the management of the Sacramento Bee. I was the arts and entertainment editor, and my editor really didn't want me weighing in on a political campaign, and I understood that. Had I not been an editor, perhaps, maybe I would have, but he asked me not to write about it at the time, and I didn't.
Well, he didn't want you to write this book, in fact.
Well, yeah. Well, I wouldn't have had time to write this book while I was still working there. But I understand that. You have one editorial policy at a newspaper. I did not own the paper, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but I did feel that I had to go along with his request at the time.
In hindsight now, looking back at what you feel you accomplished and didn't accomplish, are there things that you would change? And I'm thinking primarily of a reference you made to the protesters, the youthful protesters on the university campus, on the edge of, as you call it, arrogance.
I think it's true. Most young people think, you know, I certainly experienced it with my own children. I raised, my wife and I had a blended family of four children. So we had four teenagers at various times. And teenagers think they know everything. I certainly did at the time when I was young. I remember if my parents would offer me advice in the 60s from their experience in the 30s, you know, I thought, well, they're a bunch of old farts. So I understand that arrogance of youth. It's one of the reasons in my book that I'm not trying to give lessons to young activists. I think there are lessons one could draw from my book, and I'm happy to talk about them. I'm not preachy in there. I'm not saying you should do this. Here's my program for you. That would be arrogant. But no, I think at the time we were impatient. And I understand our impatience. The war was going on every day. It never stopped. It was always on the evening news. It was always in our lives with the draft, with guys coming home in boxes. We wanted the war to end, and we didn't see how we really had to dig in for a long struggle. And I think because of that, some things that happened were way too rash. We should have been better at building coalitions. I think at the time I felt that electoral politics was basically corrupt and too dominated by money. I mean, that certainly sounds familiar now. But at the time, I wasn't really big into backing anti-war candidates, and I think I was wrong about that. I think every kind of tactic should have been used, you know, every kind of legal tactic, from writing your congressman to having public protest, having civil disobedience, to electing anti-war people. My attitude at the time is probably an example of the arrogance of youth.
In hindsight, though, one of the things that we've seen as a result of that war is that presidents no longer having the conscription availability to enlist as many people as they can, they now use the National Guard as the first line of defense.
Right, that's a huge change, because back in the day that I'm writing about, the National Guard was seen as a haven for mostly well-connected young men to avoid going to Vietnam, but doing their military service. I think if the governments have learned anything from the Vietnam experience, is that if you have conscription, you have a draft for an unpopular war, you are going to have an amazing amount of dissent to that. And they learned you can't fight an unpopular war with a conscripted army. And they went to, quote, the all-volunteer army, for better or for worse.
The result of this book, do you want to write more about it, the feedback you're getting? I'd like to know what's happening as the release of this book is emerging.
Well, so far the feedback's been very good. I've appeared in some bookstores, things like that. Unfortunately, the book business is not doing well these days. It's not my fault. This happened, you know, before I wrote this book. Most newspapers, including my old newspaper, the Sacramento Bee, we don't run the kind of book reviews we used to run. A lot of papers used to have book review sections. Those are almost all gone. There is stuff on the internet. There's no doubt about that. And I can talk to people like you who are interested in subjects like this. But it's harder getting the word out. That's frustrating, but that's what I expected. I've been warned about that. Whether I write something more about this, I don't know. It's probably the last thing I'll write about the 60s. I could see writing something about the 70s, though, not necessarily a memoir like this, but I think the 70s is a very interesting period. I mean, the activism didn't end just when the calendar switched, you know, from 69 to 70. So, I mean, a lot was going on. By the time I got out of prison in 71, the movement was still very strong. It might have been more fragmented, but I got very involved in the anti-war movement at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where I went when I was on parole. Those were exciting times. They were strong times. Some of the issues were different, such as women's concerns were raised by the movement. That discrimination of women against gay people were all new. But I think that's an interesting and sort of underreported period. I also conceived myself going back to, I did a lot of writing about movies. I wrote for around 15 years a column that was syndicated on DVDs, and I was particularly interested in American movies from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and sort of the impact of popular culture and the film industry and all that, and I could see returning to that subject too.
Well, Mr. Danzas, thank you so very much for this time and taking the time and effort you did to get this book out to people.
Well, thank you. It was nice talking to you.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Author and journalist Bruce Dances, Resistor. Check out the publisher's website, Cornell Press, at cornell.edu. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.
Imagine fantastic music, friendly people, and a chance to relax under the oak trees, dance, jam, and welcome summertime. The Live Oak Music Festival, Father's Day weekend, June 13th, 14th, and 15th, featuring Railroad Earth, Dave Alvin and Phil Alvin with the Guilty Ones, J.D. McPherson, Holly Williams, Reggae, Zydeco, and lots more. It's all at Live Oak Camp in the Santa Ynez Mountains. Get your tickets online at liveoakfest.org or call 805-781-3030. And now for a brief moment to check out the KCBX community calendar. Learn contra dancing and spend the night dancing with the Central Coast Country Dance Society this Saturday night at the Odd Fellows Hall in San Luis Obispo. The caller is Kelsey Hartman with the Foggy Bay String Band. For all the details, check out the community calendar at kcbx.org. This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Stay tuned next for The Splendid Table. The time is now.